The word Puritanism can engender many thoughts when you bring it up. I doubt that there are fewer words in the English language that have a more pejorative application to it than Puritan. If you say Puritan, it's like saying fundamentalist in a mainline church. Unfortunately, evangelical today doesn't raise any hack as it should. But Puritanism is something that is very difficult to get your arms around. Now, it's something that we have much of an appreciation of and an affinity for, but we have to realize that the majority of Christianity doesn't hold that affinity, for sure. And certainly the world doesn't hold that affinity. In fact, the world has very little of any understanding of who the Puritans are. I've had the privilege this week of listening to Dr. J.I. Packer's 16 hours of lectures on Puritan theology. I felt like I've gone back to a graduate school again. But as Dr. Packer, in his first lecture, he calls it scraping away the mud. He attempts to take away some of the muddy things that have been applied to Puritans and let us understand that that was not applicable terms. We'll scrape a little of the mud away next week, but I will give you one comment of mud. H.L. Mencken said, when you hear of a Puritan, it's the haunting fear that someone might be happy. This is a caricature that is not rare. You find it a lot. A twofold misconception of Puritans is, one, they had a neurotic, morbid gloom of temperament. Now, I suggest to you, nothing could be further from the truth. The Puritans were not morbid, and they didn't have gloom in their temperament. Another thing, it is said that a Puritan has a distinct hostility to the pleasures of life. Next week, we will debunk that statement. The fact that a band played to 3 a.m. in the morning after the wedding of Oliver Cromwell's daughter, and they danced to 3 a.m. in the morning, might have a little bit to do with debunking the fact that they had a hostility to the pleasures of life. Anyway, that's for next week to try to debunk these things. As we study Puritanism, I used a couple of definitions. One from the professor that Doug and I studied in graduate school under Dr. Panosian. His definition of Puritanism is it was an effort to rid the Christianity of England from all things contrary to the biblical revelation. To remove all things, whether in doctrine, discipline, ceremony, or polity, which had been added by Rome. As I consider that definition, I think Dr. Panosian is about 70% right, but he even is about 20% wrong in there. Well, 70 and 20 makes 9. That shows you why I do math. But anyway, I think he was a little off, and I'll explain that next week. Dr. Calhoun, I respect very much, says that Puritanism is a spiritual movement which developed under Elizabeth I, which was the late 16th century, blossomed in the interregnum, which was in the 1640s and 50s, and withered in the persecution between the Restoration and the Acts of Toleration in 1688. I think Dr. Calhoun puts it in a sentence that covers a lot, because Puritanism did arise at a time, it flourished at a time, and unfortunately it withered at a time. And the withering was under the intense persecution, and it led, as Dr. Packer said, to two generations of insipid ministry after the time of the Puritans, where there was very little to look at to be considered good because of the withering that occurred. Anyway, if we're going to study Puritanism, we have to set the context of when it occurred. What is the historical context of Puritanism? Now, from here on, let me give credit to our brother Doug Fincannon, because I have appropriated, which is a big word for stolen, his PowerPoint presentation from a couple of years back. His slides were so good that all I had to do is correct his spelling. And Y'all who don't know me know that's a real joke that I corrected anyone's spelling. I did find one thing he spelled wrong, though, and I did correct it. But beyond that, I think copying is the highest degree of flattery, and I'll flatter my brother. He did a great presentation. His slides were wonderful, and I didn't need to do anything but tweak them and add to them a little bit. So the slides you're getting here, I'll give credit to Doug for creating. If you remember, and I'm sure you all do with your memory being so clear, when Doug went over English Anglicanism a few weeks back, he talked about the English Reformation and how the English Reformation differed from the Reformation on the continent in Switzerland and Germany. In the English Reformation, you had four characteristics. You had the fact that it was more political than religious. Remember, it began under Henry VIII. He wanted to break with Rome so he could have the wife to give him an heir. Even from this time, the characteristic for the English Reformation, it was very much a political movement. There were no dominant spiritual figures in the English Reformation. You had good and godly men. You had good and godly Puritans who came up later. But to say that you had a leader of anywhere approaching the stature of a Luther, a Calvin, a Zwingli, or a Knox would be wrong. There was not any leader of that nature. The political leaders, the kings and queens, probably were not even converted, and if were, even in Elizabeth's case, was very, very weak. So you didn't have a dominant spiritual figure. It was more about organization than doctrine. When Paul gave that excellent presentation on the origins of Puritanism a couple of weeks back, and if you did not hear that, I think it should be a requirement for membership that you, an addendum to your requirement of membership that you listen to that, particularly paying attention to his excursion onto the regulative principle. But the point was made that from 1560 on, the church could live with a doctrinal statement, which was the 39 Articles. That was a statement that I could live with in its essence today, and you could too, and could worship if that was followed. But how it was applied, how it was worked out in the polity of the church was something that that Puritans could not abide by. So the English Reformation dealt with organization more than doctrine. It dealt with doctrine, but it was more organization. Fourthly, the English church was marked by continual upheaval. There really wasn't a time of peace in the English church. Okay, so if we want to see the framework of Puritanism, what happened when? Did I put that right? What happened? When did it happen? That's what we're going to discuss this morning. Next week, God willing, we're going to answer the question, who were the Puritans? And in that, we will get into richness that we will not be able to get into today. Today, we're going to talk about what happened when. It is hard to get for Americans who are not particularly well-trained in history, which if you are a product of the American public school system, you're not well-trained in history. If you're a product of virtually any school system, unfortunately, you're probably not that versed in history. And if you had it, you don't remember it. Anyway, what was the time that this all occurred? So we're going to try to set the time. Doug did something of that several weeks ago. Paul did something of that, certainly 2 weeks back when he discussed the origins of Puritanism. But what time did this occur? What was the framework? What happened when? The English Reformation, looking at a large chart, Doug called them the royal players. You have here everyone who was in charge during the time that the Puritanism came about and should be considered, all the way from Elizabeth at the beginning to the restoration, the glorious restoration, at the end of William and Mary. Taking this chart and looking at the people in particular, we mentioned Elizabeth, which Doug did and then Paul did also. Elizabeth was a Protestant. When she came to the throne in 1559, she inherited a country that had been racked for the last 6 years by the policies of her sister Mary, Bloody Mary, who had killed over 230 Protestants in a very violent way. She inherited this throne. It was a peoples who were very much disarray. Dr. Packer said that there were probably 20,000 churches in England at this time. Imagine, a lot of parish churches were very small. But of them, if she was going to restore Protestantism, what was she restoring it to? What was the church that was there? It was a church that had barely entered a period of Reformation under Edward VI, and it was not established at all. What was Elizabeth going to do? Paul laid out the fact, and Doug did also, that Elizabeth adopted something called the middle way. She tried to adopt and enforce a Protestantism that she felt would be acceptable, but she also felt that all would have to agree. In her mind, it would have been impossible to have a multiplicity of church worships. It needed to be one way. And establishing that way and the Episcopal way, it gave rise to the opposition of the Puritans. They were very concerned with the policies that was being enacted, the doctrines they could accept. They could accept the 39 Articles. But they said that the churches, one, needed preachers, which Elizabeth and the Parliament was not providing for because they didn't give money for training. And they needed freedom to worship. The Puritan name, by the end of the 16th century, had begun to be applied both to preachers and to the laity who sought for a clarification and a cleaning up of the church practice. After Elizabeth, who died a natural death, last week we mentioned the fact that James I came to the throne of England from the throne of Scotland. James I brought the Stuart family into the ascendancy, and the throne then went to James. James I, we will discuss him briefly. James was an accomplished man. He was King James VI of Scotland. His mother was Mary, Queen of Scots. He became the regent at age 13 months when his mother abdicated the throne and moved to England. He was raised by Presbyterians. He should have been a good Presbyterian, but he was not a good Presbyterian. James became King of England in 1603 when Elizabeth died. When James becomes King of England, then he begins to use the phrase Great Britain. Great Britain actually began when you had the unification of the throne of Scotland and England in 1603. James was an accomplished man. He was fluent in Greek, Latin, French, English, and his native Scots. He was schooled also in Italian and Spanish. James was not a dummy. But James had problems. He had physical problems. He was sickly. He had arthritis, weak limbs, colic, gout, a number of other illnesses. He had physical handicaps, as it says here, which prevented him and affected his legs, his tongue. There were always people looking to remove James from the land of the living. He had to be protected at all times. Unfortunately, we also have to conclude that James was not morally as pure as he could have been. His major concern when he came to the throne of England was to unite the monarchy under a form of government that would let the king acknowledge the king to be head of the church. He wanted a centralized and a powerful monarchy. When he ascended the throne, every group thought he might be on their side. Roman Catholics, the Presbyterians, and the Anglicans. His mother, remember, was a Roman Catholic, Mary, Queen of Scots. And the Roman Catholics hoped that James, when he became fully invested as the king of both countries, that his affinity for Roman Catholicism would rise. They were disappointed. The Presbyterians from Scotland thought that he would bring with him the understanding of the church that he had been taught with from the days of his youth. He had professed at one time to agree with the national covenant that had been signed in 1638. He had agreed with the Second Book of Discipline of 1581. Let me get it back right. He had agreed to that at one time. But he was, as S.M. Houghton said, a man of vacillating character. When he got to the throne, the Presbyterians were very disappointed. The Anglicans thought that he would be their man because Episcopacy
in its organization had the king as the head of the church, and the bishops would support the king. Well, the Episcopalians were correct because James did so much support the Anglican cause. He famously said, "No bishop, no king." He recognized that. He wanted to see the divine right of kings put up. Dr. Packer said that he looked forward to being in a country where the clergy could not instruct the king on what he should do. If you remember last week we spoke about in Scotland, it was the habit of the clergy to believe that they could give instruction to the king. We remember what Andrew Melville said to the king, that he was only a member of the church. He was not head of the church, and he was not lord in the church. James was anxious to be rid of that. And when he got to England, he got rid of that. The Presbyterians immediately appealed to the new king. They issued something called the Millenary Petition. The word came from probably 1,000 members or Puritans that signed this. They petitioned the king for a number of things. There was a conference held at Hampton Court, 1604. The Puritans asked the following reforms to be done: the signing of the cross and baptism to be removed, confirmation to be done away with, the administration of baptism by women to be disallowed, the use of the ring in marriage not to be permitted. Now, that was only, by the way, now I don't wear a wedding ring because I lost mine. It was lost for like 18 months, and then I found it in a pair of pants that I hadn't worn, and I was so happy. But then 2 months later, I lost it again. I really do want to get married and stay married. I've been married 39 years, but the price of gold is so high now, and I'm so cheap, being Scottish and all that, you know. But one day, I think the ring's in the house. I have a memory. You have one of these memories? I have a memory of being in subconsciousness when I took it off and said to myself, "Be careful, you're going to lose it again." Well, I lost it again. Now, where does a memory come from like that? We're not going to get into the metaphysical. But anyway, the ring is somewhere. But I am married, but I just don't wear it. But you see, the wedding ring symbolized a sacrament, one of the 7 sacraments in the Catholic Church. And marriage, though honored, is not a sacrament. So that's why they wanted the elimination of the use of the wedding ring. Bowing in the name of Jesus, I think we can understand why that shouldn't be done. The dress of ministers. The Anglican minister wore a vestment, which was like a white cloak over him like that. If you wore a vestment, did not that separate you from the people? It made you something as a go-between, intermediary between God and the people. And it elevated you to a position that you probably didn't need to be elevated to, or certainly the church should not recognize. The priests at this time actually lived in the church. They didn't want that. Absolution given to someone as they died certainly didn't want that. They called for all church discipline to be carried out by the church and not for insignificant matters. Discipline was for something major. Well, James rejected out of hand all of these things. The only thing that came out of this Hampton Court conference was James's decision to authorize the translation of a new Bible. Now, you might say, that's good, isn't it? But let me tell you the reasons that he wanted this. The Bible that was being used at this time was the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible was a great translation, but you see, it had notes with it. Now, some people have opposition to a Bible with notes. And you know, some of us have experience of a Bible with notes that can lead you astray, i.e. the Scofield Reference Bible. We'll leave that for modern fundamentalism when we teach it next spring. But you see, a Bible with notes can certainly give you a superstructure of operation that you could follow and think that it was the teaching of the Word of God. That's what the Scofield Bible did. Well, James didn't like the Geneva Bible because the notes of the Geneva Bible were certainly geared to a Presbyterian understanding of church polity, not an Episcopal understanding of church polity. So he wanted the Geneva Bible gone, so he authorized the translation of the New Bible, which is called the King James Version. That is an excellent translation, served the church well for 400 years. It is not inspired. But there is one good thing. If you think it is, just listen to James White's lectures on the King James Version only. That's all. Nothing else could be said than what Dr. White has said about it there. But the King James Bible was a good thing. He turned against the Puritans. It was very, very difficult to live under James from this time forward. Presbyterians appealed to him. He rejected it. He was, it says, low moral character, which served to discredit him. It is purported that he was homosexual, certainly surrounded himself with people of that inclination and ilk, appointed people in his court that were of very low character and morals. The Declaration of Sports, which was issued in 1618, the Puritans had an idea of a Sabbath that was a holy day, a day of holy rest and of holy work. Well, as an aggravation to such, in 1618, this Book of Sports was issued by the king, by his authority, that laid out the appropriate sports that could be conducted and engaged in that day. It was just a dig at the Puritans. He failed to support the Protestants in the 30 Years' War that was occurring on the continent, particularly in Germany. His own brother was on the Protestant side there. He failed to offer support. We'll leave that for James. The next king that's going to come to the throne is James's son, Charles I. James does die a natural death, as Elizabeth did, which was a good thing. Here's a picture of Charles. I reckon since they didn't have the portrait artist gave us all three views of the king. As you notice, we're entering into the time of history where there are paintings that are good likenesses of the people that we're talking about. We don't have to wonder anymore sort of what they look like. Now, was he this handsome, or if that is handsome, I don't know. He certainly had a nice-sized nose. They didn't make that any smaller, did they? King Charles I. Charles was more moral than his father, but he was less politically savvy. It seemed that every political decision that Charles made was probably the wrong decision at the wrong time. He married a Catholic queen, Henrietta Maria of France. He'd attempted to marry someone from Spain before that. Now, Spain was under the rule of the Habsburg family. Can we say the Holy Roman Emperor and the Holy Roman Empire? And the Parliament said, no, you're not going to marry a Spanish person. But he marries a French lady instead, who was obviously Catholic. She brings with her priest. She sets up in the castle a miniature Catholic church and obviously engages in the mass there for her days. A constant problem for our Puritan brethren. He appoints William Laud, who was Archbishop of Canterbury. First, he appoints him as head of a council, a commission, and then a few years later makes him archbishop. Laud is an avowed Roman Catholic. He makes really no bones about it. He is an Arminian in his theology. He would oppose any and everything that the Puritans stood for. Under Laud, there was much persecution. Conflict with Parliament, Charles had continually from 1629 on. The main part of the conflict was money. Charles needed money to build an army and to do things. Parliament was alone had the right for taxation. You had to have taxes come from Parliament. You see, this little idea of taxation was going on. It meant a lot to the Puritans. Remember the ones over there and the ones that came here? So he couldn't get Parliament to agree with him, so he disbanded Parliament and tried to rule for the next 11 years with no Parliament. Under the time of Charles is when the emigration begins to the New World. First, we see some emigration to Holland. We see the independents leaving Holland, coming back to England and coming to America as the Plymouth Colony in 1620. And then the Massachusetts Bay Colony was the great exodus of Puritans from 1630 on due to the policies of Laud. And you had the removal of a large, large number of Puritans from England to America in 1630. So the exodus of the Puritans happened under the time of Charles. Charles blundered greatly. He gave Laud control over Scotland. Laud goes up there and attempts to impose episcopacy. Remember Jenny Geddes that we talked about last week and throwing her stool at the dean who was reading a liturgy that was not the Presbyterian liturgy at the church at Greyfriars. They were attempting to put episcopacy in Scotland, and the Scottish people said no. So their opposition arises there. War turns out between Scotland and England. Charles has no money to put up an army, so he goes to the Irish to help. Now, the Irish were Catholics, okay, so the Irish are going to help him. This army that Charles is able to raise, obviously to the Protestants in England and Puritans, and the Protestants in Scotland, the Presbyterians, is an affront to their freedom. Here is a Catholic army coming under the banner of the king to oppose us. So the Scottish Presbyterians and the English Protestants, which were Puritans, joined together in opposition to this. They won. He called Parliament back. It was a short Parliament. Scotland wins. He forces a long Parliament. Civil war breaks out in the land between 1642 and 1648. The forces of the king are called cavaliers. They dressed fancily, had the hats and the plumes because they were mainly from the class of aristocracy and nobility. The roundheads was the phrase given to the common men who made up Parliament's army. They did not have the finery. They wore their hair a little bit shorter. Remember how the king's hair, well, you can see how the king's hair, and the aristocracy would wear their hair long. The Parliament forces were called the roundheads because they would wear hair short enough that you could actually see that your head was round. Novel concept. The Civil War went on for 6 years. During the Civil War, you had Parliament that abolished the episcopal framework of church government. It was very necessary at this time. The English Parliament curried the favor of the Scottish Presbyterians. The most powerful army in the island was the Scottish army at this time. The English Puritans probably were not as Presbyterian as they asserted. They tended to be more congregational and independent in their view of church government, but they needed the Presbyterians. And so Parliament abolishes episcopacy and adopts Presbyterian form of government. It was expedient to do this because you had to have the Scottish on your side. We mentioned last week that at this time the Solemn League and Covenant was signed between the Scottish Presbyterians and the English Puritans. This document called for the preservation and advancement of the church in Scotland, which was already reformed, and the reformation of the church in England and Ireland, which needed reformation. So this was signed. It was an agreement between the two. During the Civil War, Parliament called together the Westminster Assembly. The Westminster Assembly not only advised in doctrinal things, it advised in political things. It was during this time that Samuel Rutherford wrote Lex Rex, which laid out the understanding of law and that the law should come from the agreement of the people, not from the divine right of the king. Charles I was very much hammering on this thing that the king had the right, the divine right to rule and to rule as a sole monarch. Rule without query of the people that he was ruling over. Parliament was saying, no, this would not be. The Westminster Assembly had 121 clergy, 30 laymen. There were, 6 or 9 clergy from Scotland came down, the leading one being Samuel Rutherford. The Directory of Worship was issued, the Westminster Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechism were written. These have become the standards of Reformed understanding up through this day. The Second London Confession that we have adopted and hold here mirrors the outline and the layout of the Westminster Confession, the substantial differences being understanding of magistrates and understanding of church polity, which are things that should have been changed. But anyway, the Westminster Confession, the Westminster Standards, the Westminster Assembly advised Parliament during this time. Parliament, by the way, Dr. Packer made this point, which I had never heard, that the Puritan name was dropped at this time, and they were called Presbyterians. I had never thought of the fact that the name was dropped. I would not disagree with J.I. Packer hardly about anything, and certainly about anything to do with English history and Puritanism. But in my study, I had never come across that. Pastor Fisher, had you? Paul, have you? Well, he says it. You know, he's an Englishman, and he's an authority, so we'll just leave it at that. And it makes sense that the Puritans would be called Presbyterians from this time on, because they were. I mean, they had adopted that, and they adopted it as a form of government. Well, this Parliament, which was full of good Puritans, arrested Archbishop Laud and had him executed. Simple as that. Can't say any more about it. Did they have the right to do that? Under English law, they had the right to do that. Before God, did they have the right to do that? Not real sure. Probably not. Yeah, I shouldn't say not real sure. They really didn't, because it wasn't an offense punishable by death that you can support from scriptures. But it was acceptable in the 17th century to do this, and they did it, and should not be unfairly or unduly criticized for it. Not only did they take the head of the archbishop off, they took the head of the king off. And this was for several reasons. One of them being, most truly, that he was duplicitous. He had attempted to negotiate with the Scots, the Catholics, and 40 members of Parliament all at the same time, and all with a different result. He was willing to go with any of them that would let him be king. I think that it was Ian Murray that said that what's the phrase we used about Charles last week, how indecisive he was in his decisions. But anyway, Charles was executed. His head was removed. After Charles, you have this was the period of civil war. Then you have the period, it's called the interregnum. The interregnum simply means that it was between kings. The country had no king. From 1648 or 49 to 1660, the country operated with no king. Well, if it had no king, how did it operate? It operated as a commonwealth. Who was the leader of this commonwealth? As you'll see here, a man by the name of Oliver Cromwell becomes the Lord Protector, that word was left off here, and the leader of the Parliament. Oliver Cromwell, a man probably as reviled in English history and in history books as anybody else that you can find. If they didn't like the Puritans, they liked Cromwell less. It's not our purpose to resurrect the reputation of Oliver Cromwell, but let's just state the fact. He was a wealthy landowner. He was descended from an advisor to Henry VIII. He was converted. He became a Puritan independent. He loved nothing better than studying his Bible. When the Civil War broke out, he returned home. He raised a cavalry unit. Now, this was unusual for Parliament's forces, because Parliament's forces were soldiers. They were from the merchant class and the lower class. They didn't have horses. The King's party had horses because they were the nobility. So the King's party and the King's army always had the advantage of having a cavalry. Well, Oliver Cromwell raised a cavalry for the Parliament forces. After the king was defeated at Naseby, Cromwell led the Protestant cavalry. After this, the Scots sided with Charles, the Irish rebelled, the English Protestants splintered. There was real problems, but the king was beheaded. Cromwell disbanded Parliament. He became Lord Protector. It is something Cromwell set out to reform, church and state. Under Cromwell, everyone who was legitimate could worship. What do you mean by legitimate? If you were orthodox, if you could pass a test of orthodoxy, and there was a council that examined ministers to see if they were orthodox, it didn't examine their church polity. It examined their doctrinal understanding. And if you could pass the test of orthodoxy, you can minister. This was a time that the Baptists were able to minister freely. Presbyterians were able to minister freely. Congregationalists, which tended to be independents, that is, the church called its own pastor and managed its own affairs without regard to any other ecclesiastical body being over it, they were able to operate. The Jews were able to operate. In fact, to tell the truth, the Roman Catholics that existed were able to operate even at this time because there was a sense of toleration under Cromwell. He set out to reform church and state, but he allowed for this worship. His religious policies were fair and tolerant. Now, the Puritan Presbyterians, as Doug has noted here, continued to fight for a state church. There was political unrest. He was offered the throne of England. I have the quote here. Dr. Packer says, "Parliament was full of saints of God who were terrible at government." Addendum, sidelight. Do not ever equate someone's profession of faith and even their spirituality and their ability to operate in the church of God with an ability to operate in politics and government. I wish the two went hand in hand. We have multiple instances and illustrations of where they don't. Do we want politicians who are godly? Yes. Do we want politicians who are smart and will rule well? Yes. Should the two things be married together? Yes. Are they always? No. So someone says, "Well, I'm going to vote for this man because he's a member of Believers Baptist Church and da 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 da," and but he's an, no offense, an idiot. And you know, you don't vote for an idiot just because he happens to be a Christian. He can be a godly Christian and be an idiot in politics. So you got to balance these things. Parliament was full of saints, but they were terrible at government. Upon the death of Cromwell, he died a natural death. His son Richard comes to supposed power, but is not able. Richard is really not able to keep things together. The tensions, the country's breaking apart. What are you going to do? Parliament, even the Puritans, the Anglicans, they agreed, we need a king. They call for Charles II, who had been exiled to France, son obviously of Charles I and grandson of James, to come back to England. This is the restoration that we talked about last week from 1660 to 1685 is the time of Charles II. My, what a pretty boy. I would imagine that he did not let the wart be painted on his nose as Cromwell did on his picture because he just wanted to be pretty. Charles II came in. He was, I should get to my notes. It's another page over here. Under Charles II, the first thing Parliament does, it issues an Acts of Uniformity. The Acts of Uniformity call essentially for three things. The Episcopal ordination for all pastors. Now, from 1642 to 1660, you had many men entering the pastorate who were not episcopally ordained. They had not been ordained by a bishop. They had been, their ordination was recognized by the church. They were duly ordained, but not ordained by the bishop. From this point on, every pastor had to be episcopally ordained. And they said you had to ask for it if you didn't have it. This is a big problem. The Acts of Uniformity also said that all pastors had to take an oath of consent. This oath of consent was the fact that it was saying that the 39 articles you were usable and they would all agree to that. They were usable. The 39 articles as a confession of faith were usable. But you also had to say that they needed no improvement whatsoever. And the ministers could not agree to that because they felt that the 39 articles in several of the points were weak, and they are weak, and they needed improvement. So the Act of Uniformity said that you had to be ordained by a bishop. Secondly, you had to consent that the 39 articles needed no improvement. They could not do that. Thirdly, they must regard the solemn league and covenant as an unlawful oath. Now, you're saying to men that your brethren who have died, by the way, many of them for the cause, were totally wrong to call for the reformation of the church. That's what the solemn league and covenant did. It called for the reformation of the church. And you were going to say here that that was wrong and that if you had signed that, you were guilty of treason. And that's exactly what they did. We ended up last week talking about James Guthrie O'Stickerfoot as he was brought to trial in Scotland because he was a signer of the Solemn League and Covenant. This was very bad. This led to St. Bartholomew's Day, 1662, the expulsion of over 2,000 Puritan pastors. Pastors like John Owen, John Goodwin, Richard Baxter. It called for the expulsion of Baptist pastors because these men couldn't sign this thing. So you had 2,000 of the best ministers in the churches in England expelled from their pulpits at this day. From 1662 to 1665, the Puritans attempted to live somewhat quietly because they felt that surely Parliament would do something to change these requirements and that they would be restored to the ability to pastor again. Something happened in 1665, though, that was really cataclysmic. The end of that year and through the winter of the next, you had the plague in London. This was probably the bubonic plague. It is estimated that, I don't remember if it was 10,000 or 20,000. The numbers kind of blur in my mind. I know there was 20,000 going to come up in a minute, but there were thousands upon thousands of people dying of the plague in London. The ministers in London who had signed the Acts of Uniformity were bastions of pastoral care, and they gathered together and decided that since so many people were dying, they might die, so they would leave London. And they did. All the pastors virtually who were in London still pastoring because they had signed the Acts, they left. They just left their parish. The Puritan pastors who were out of their parishes, were out in the countryside, saw the void, and they literally went to London and ministered to the people. They went and ministered in the midst of this plague and carried gospel, comfort, and truth to the people. If that is not illustrative of the character of the men that were in the pulpits at this time, who could agree with the Acts of Uniformity and who could not, I don't know what else could. London eventually burned later that spring, and with the burning of the city, it eliminated the germ. What is it, the flea that causes the bubonic plague, isn't it? I think it's the flea. Anyway, the Puritan ministers assumed that due to their efforts, it would be well rewarded and recognized. Unfortunately, Parliament comes back and says, no, you still can't be ministers, and you're totally unauthorized to minister. The church from 1666 goes underground. For the next 22 years, the church in England operates as an underground church, much as it did in Scotland with the Covenanters and the Conventicles that we talked about last week. From 1666 to 1688, over 20,000 Puritans, not only pastors now, but Puritan laymen were arrested. It was a time of persecution. Honestly, as Dr. Calhoun says, this time of persecution withered the Puritan numbers to such a degree that even after the Glorious Restoration, the Puritanism was not what it could have been. Charles died in 1665. He died confessing on his deathbed the Roman Catholic faith. He had always been a Roman Catholic at heart. He died confessing that. After Charles, his brother, James II, comes to the throne. James II, another good hair day, wouldn't you say? James II was not a closet Roman Catholic like Charles. He was an avowed Roman Catholic. He opted and worked to bring Roman Catholicism back to the land. He brought Jesuits and monks, appointed Catholics to high office, totally enraged the people. His wife presented him a son, which ensured that there would be an heir to the throne. Parliament could not stand for this. James was harried out of the land, and the Glorious Revolution led to the ascension of William and Mary, who we spoke about last week. They came in 1688. She had a line to the throne. They were Protestants. The Religious Acts of Toleration, 1689, allowed for men who would subscribe to the 39 Articles and swear loyalty to the sovereign to become pastors again. James II fled to Europe. He went to Ireland. He got an army. They came to take the throne back. He was defeated. And the end of James's reign started a time of somewhat peace in England for the next number of years. This time, and I stole one more chart from Doug, the development of English Protestantism, if you remember when he used this, from the Anglican High Church, which was Arminian, the Puritans came down in here, which was the Low Church. The Low Church separated with the Separatists. We'll mention them in a couple of weeks because they went to Holland. The State Church, the Puritans, you had the division of the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, Independents. Tony, James, would you give out these sheets? In our next 7 minutes, we're going to read a description of an English Puritan. This was something that was written in 1646 by a man by the name of John Geary. He calls it the character of an old English Puritan or nonconformist. I want you just to have this. I'm going to put it up here for you, but I want you to have it in your hands to look at as we're reading this. And we'll look at what they say about this Puritan, how they describe him, because out of this description, we'll get a picture that I hope will expand next week. As they're handing them out, I'm going to go ahead and begin. The old English Puritan was such a one that honored God above all, and under God gave everyone his due. His first care was to serve God, and therein he did not what was good in his own, but in God's sight, making the word of God the rule of his worship. In this first few sentences, Geary says that a Puritan gave everyone his due. He respected every man and treated him fairly. But his first obligation, as he says, was to serve God. And in serving God, he sought to do what was right in God's sight, not in his sight. He wanted the word of God to rule in his worship. Paul went over that in the understanding of the regulative principle. This was a Puritan. He highly esteemed order in the house of God, but would not, under color of that, submit to superstitious rites, which are superfluous and perish in their use. He did not disagree with having a liturgy. A Puritan could live in a church with a liturgy, a set order of service that included responsiveness from the people and the pastor. Every church, by the way, has a liturgy. Whether it's written down or not, every church has an order of worship. It is so much a part of modern evangelicalism to want to reject liturgy and say that all liturgy is wrong. It's a part of some who love liturgy that is more formal to say that the freedom to worship differently is wrong. I think both camps are wrong. Liturgy should be able to be appreciated. When the liturgy includes such things as reciting the Nicene Creed or even the Apostles' Creed, when the liturgy involves things such as responsive reading from the Psalms and other things, this is not a bad thing. And we should not have a gut check reaction, ooh, like that, if we enter into worship with someone who follows a more formal liturgy. There's something to be said for appreciation of that. But the liturgy should not, the Puritans said, involve rites that they called them superstitious. That is, the kneeling to get the sacraments, the crossing of yourself, the bowing at the name of Jesus, etc., like that. These are superstitious rites. They should not be in the church. He made conscious of all God's ordinances, though some he esteemed of more consequence. Now, the Anglicans would use the word sacraments. And the sacrament is an ecclesiastical word, but it's not a biblical word. The things that we observe in the church, baptism, the Lord's Supper, are really ordinances. They've been ordained by God. They don't earn you anything, but they're things that God has ordained for the benefit of his people. He was much in prayer. With it, he began and closed the day. In it, he was exercised in his closet, family, and public assembly. That sentence is pregnant with something that is so characteristic of a Puritan. He was a man of prayer. And that extended, as it says in that sentence, to his closet. It is said that the Puritans prayed out loud. It was very common for the Puritans to pray out loud. There was a story told of a Puritan man who prayed in his attic. That was his private place of prayer. And he prayed out loud. And he must have had a voice similar to some people we know have booming voices. And his servants, and all Puritan pastors usually had servants because most of them were farmers, and you had servants working on your farm. They would hear him praying out of the attic in the mornings, and he was praying sometimes for them. And so can you imagine what it would be if you were out tilling and you heard the voice of your master, who was a pastor, in the attic praying for you out loud? I don't know if you pray out loud alone or not. Different people have different ways of praying. But think about this. The formation of a word, whether you're forming your lips and praying silently, but yet forming words and moving your lips, puts a substance to prayer that may be different than just thinking in your mind. It may be putting a substance to it, and it may have a real benefit. Anyway, he was a man who began and closed the day with prayer. He exercised it in his closet, in his family, and in the public assembly. The family prayers and the Christian home was a concept that came from Puritanism that was really not known hardly anywhere else of family worship. The public assembly, he believed not only in the formal prayers, but extemporaneous prayers. We must move on. He esteemed that manner of prayer best, where by the gift of God, expressions were varied according to present wants and occasions, yet he did not account set forms unlawful. He could pray in a church that used written prayers. They were not unlawful to use written prayers, but extemporaneous praying was very necessary because there were things that you need to pray for that were not written down by people who wrote. But if you can't find value from the written prayers, I mean, if we can't, we need to examine ourselves, because there's value in written prayers, and they even can be used in public. Therefore, in that circumstance of the church, he did not wholly reject the liturgy, but the corruption of it. He esteemed reading of the word an ordinance of God, both in private and public, but he did not account reading to be preaching. As we've said, the Elizabethan church was so void of preachers. Richard Hooker said that, well, if the word was read, and in the Episcopal prayer book and in the service, the word was read, the Old Testament and the New Testament lesson was read, that was enough. And the Puritan said, no, that's not enough. You needed preaching. What type of preaching did you need? He accounted perspicuity or clarity the best grace of a preacher, and by that method best, which was most helpful to understanding, affection, and memory. He wanted preaching that was clear. Muddled preaching did no one any good. But he wanted preaching that allowed him to understand what God was requiring and called from him an affection. This we're going to bring out next week when we consider Puritan preaching. Affection is something that was called for by the Puritans in response to the Word of God. Dispositional attitudes which have the emotion of love behind it, Jonathan Edwards said, is what preaching should cause. Dispositional attitudes. Your disposition is changed. And the motivation, though, is not fear. It's not obligation. It's love. It's love to God is what's the change. And you are affectionate. Positive, joyous affection for God. And you should be able to remember. Memory. That's a good thing. You know, if preaching had points that were distinct, and maybe three of them, you might could remember them. Man, never know about that. Anyway, he accounted purpose. Ooh, I did that twice, didn't I? Wanted to make that point. The Lord's Day he esteemed a divine ordinance and rest on it necessary so far as it induced to holiness. He was very conscientious in the observance of that day as the marked day of the soul. The Puritan Sabbath is something we'll discuss next week versus the Continental Sabbath. Mart Day is something everyone would understand. There was a market day in every village and town where goods were brought in and people shopped for what they needed. The Sabbath was to be for the Puritan the market day of the soul, where he engaged as, I put the quote down. Matthew Henry said, it's a day of holy rest that it ought to be a day of holy work. You know, it's a day that you do things that feed your soul for the coming week. That's what the Lord's Day to him was. The sacrament of baptism he received in infancy, which he looked back to in his age to answer his engagements and claim his privileges. Their idea of baptism was it was a commitment from God, the covenant of God, committing themselves to the salvation of the children, but it did not call salvation. It was a commitment, they said, to the conversion by the one being baptized at the appropriate time. It escapes me how the baby being baptized could be making a commitment to be converted later, but we will leave that alone. The Lord's Supper, he accounted part of his soul's food, to which he labored to be kept an appetite. He esteemed it an ordinance of nearest communion with Christ, so requiring most exact preparation. It was something that was done more frequently than twice a year, and you prepared for it. He accounted religion and engagement to duty, that the best Christians should be the best husbands, best wives, best parents, best children, best masters, best servants, best magistrates, best subjects, that the doctrine of God might be adorned and not blasphemed. His family, he endeavored to make a church, both in regard of persons and exercises, admitting none into it but such as feared God, and laboring that those who were born in it might be born again to God. He was a man of a tender heart, not only regard of his own sin, but others' misery, not counting mercy arbitrary, but a necessary duty. You gave away because people needed it. Wherein, as he prayed for wisdom to direct him, so he studied for cheerfulness and a bounty to act. Cheerfulness, note that word. In his habit, he avoided costliness and vanity, neither exceeding his degree in civility nor declining what suited with Christianity, desiring in all things to express gravity. Gravity is not morbidity here. We'll talk about it next week. Finally, his whole life he accounted a warfare wherein Christ was his captain, his arms, his prayers, and tears. The cross, his banner, and his word, vincit quae paturte, which literally means suffering, I conquer. Conquering, I suffer. Triumph over, in, and through great grace. The Puritan fought. He lost the fight earthly. He won the fight heavenly. Thank you for your time and attention. I hope I didn't run over too much. God bless.